This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Let's find out what's on today's program. In the April 2022 edition of Pianist Magazine, Erica Wirth asks concert pianist Craig Shepherd about the piano music of Brahms. How did you become aware of the forgotten Brahms piece, Albumblatt? In 2011, I was giving a Brahms cycle in Seattle. The musicologist and Brahms specialist, George Bozart, is a friend of mine. He happened to call me a few days before one of my concerts, and he told me about a manuscript that had come into the market. He didn't realize that I was playing my third Brahms recital in just a few days. It was perfect timing. Was it easy to program? I looked at it and I thought it was a big deal. It's just 32 bars, but it's perfect for an encore. What's special about the Albumblatt? It's a haunting piece. The theme is familiar from in the Scherzo of Brahms' Horn Trio, Opus 40, which dates from some years later. The Horn Trio, which I've performed a lot, is in A-flat minor, whereas the Albumblatt is in A minor. In fact, the theme feels even more haunting in A minor. Do you still perform the Albumblatt? I only played it on that occasion. I felt it was right at that moment in time when it was discovered. And it's just an album leaf, as the title says. I have played shorter encores. The 10-second or so Bagatelle, Opus 119 by Beethoven, springs to mind. But I haven't felt compelled to program it regularly. Do you feel an affinity with Brahms? I love Brahms. I've loved him since I was a kid. I played my first Brahms cycle at Wigmore Hall in 1979. When I did the cycle in Seattle in 2011, I decided to leave out the Paganini variations because I didn't think I could do them justice any longer. I have small hands, and to manage those double notes, life is too short. Which Brahms pieces mean the most to you? I think the Opus 76 set is overlooked, and the late pieces, Opus 116 to 119, Brahms wrote them in the early 1890s. He was actually going to hang up his hat in 1889, but then he heard the clarinetist, Richard Mühlfeld, who played in the Meiningen Orchestra. He was so inspired by Mühlfeld's playing that he began to compose again. Hence, the clarinet trio, Opus 114, the quintet, Opus 115, and the Opus 120 sonatas. If it wasn't for Mühlfeld, we wouldn't have those Opus 116 to 119 pieces. Do you feel it's important to teach Brahms? I often teach his music, but some students are never going to get it. Chopin can be like this, too. Certain students can play everything, but when it comes to a Chopin nocturne, they won't touch it. I once had an undergraduate who could play the Liszt E-flat with orchestra. Really, like Argerich. And the fastest octaves you've ever heard of the Schumann Toccata. But he couldn't play Brahms or Chopin. Can you elaborate further? Their music communicates a very specific outlook on life. Don't you feel warm and cozy with Brahms? I feel like Brahms is hugging me. His music can envelop you. You feel warm and fuzzy. How would you compare that feeling to playing Schumann? Schumann is also lyrical, but he's crazy. He loved to play puzzles. To play puzzles with people. When you're dealing with one hand over the other, I'm sure he was laughing and saying, "I wonder how they're going to figure that out." If you regroup things with Schumann, he's much easier to play. In Brahms, you don't need to do that. Brahms doesn't play pianistic tricks. In the October 12, 2023 edition of the Guardian newspaper, Kate Connolly interviews Joanna Malwitz, the new chief conductor at the Berlin Konzerthaus. For months, Joanna Malwitz's image has been plastered on billboards throughout Berlin, heralding her arrival as the new chief conductor at the Konzerthaus. She is, they proclaim, the next big thing. A virtual unknown figure in the Berlin capital until recently, the musician says she can no longer go to the supermarket or local bakery without being recognized. "The build-up was massive," says Malwitz, who was inaugurated last month. "I had to push it all away from me, saving myself, as it were, by concentrating on getting to know the musicians, or on how I wanted to conduct bar 17 of a particular symphony." It is with a certain unease that Malwitz seeks to explain the enthusiasm with which her appointment has been received. There is her youth. Having started her career at aged 19, she is now aged 37, by far the youngest music director to lead a house in Berlin's teeming classical music world, which boasts 7 large orchestras and 3 opera houses. There is also the fact that she is female. In the more than 300 years in which the city has proved its global status as a thriving and influential music center, her appointment marks the first time the top job in a leading Berlin orchestra has been given to a woman. "This is of absolutely no relevance to my work," she says, approaching the issue with caution. "When you're standing in front of an orchestra, you're only concerned with one question. Does it work or not? It's what a conductor's life depends on." On the other hand, Malwitz is quick to say she's not realitätsfremd, out of touch with reality. "I realize there is still the need to talk about these matters. The perfect situation would be if we arrive at a place when it is no longer interesting to even ask me the question." The comparisons between Malwitz and Lydia Tarr, the chief conductor of a large Berlin orchestra played by Cate Blanchett in Todd Field's psychodrama, have been rife. There have even been references to the supposed targeting of Malwitz by the Konzerthaus's publicity team. She elegantly dismisses them. "I know it's ridiculous. I really want to see the film, and I adore Cate Blanchett. But it's been such a whirlwind, I've had no time. But the comparisons between me and her, well, it's just the hair, right? To be honest, people have been saying to me for the past 20 years that I and Blanchett look a little bit alike. And, you know, I'm sure she has no clue about me." Friends, perhaps the same ones who says originally tried to steer her away from the Shark Tank world of conducting, have told her enough about the film for her to ask whether it's actually a good thing to be compared with a fictional tear, a haughty, paranoid autocrat. In contrast, the musicians who work under Malwitz talk of her lack of hubris. Absolutely modest, completely subservient to the music, is how one harpist from Nuremberg's State Theater describes her. When Malwitz left as general music director after 5 years at the Bavarian city, 65,000 people attended an emotional open-air farewell concert in July. Not generally known to eulogize, Berlin's music critics have been unusually effervescent. The reviewer of her debut concerthaus performance in the Berlin tabloid BZ described her conducting style as high voltage, her interpretation of Prokofiev as refreshing, raw, risk-taking, and said she had unleashed the galloping youthful furor of Kurt Weill's Berlin Symphony, her dance-like movements suggesting she was strung with elastic. The Süddeutsche praised her ability to plumb the emotional depths of the music. Der Spiegel, as described Malwitz, just 3 years old when the Berlin Wall fell, as the antithesis of the antiquated image of the maestro, embodied in such towering figureheads as 80-year-old Daniel Berenbaum, whose resignation for health reasons as general music director of the Staatsoper, after 30 years, caused shockwaves across the classical music community. And his recently announced successor and former rival, 64-year-old conservative heavyweight Christian Tilemann. Diplomatically adept, she responds, "You know, there are also so many other people out there, men and women, who are a counterpoint to the antique maestro." She has congratulated Tilemann, she says, recalling the joy she felt as a student 2 decades ago in Berlin of slipping into his rehearsals and those of the city's other great conductors like Sir Simon Rattle, and realizing their own counterparts were in the stalls watching them. "I thought, this is amazing. This sort of support, comradeship, and exchange, which is what makes this city so rich. It's wrong to talk of rivalries. You can learn something from everyone, and everyone is very different. It's a privilege for me to be a small part of that now." At the same time, she says, "It's no longer enough to say I'll don my dress coat, take to the stage, bow, direct my symphony, and expect people to be drawn to the concert hall. It would be presumptuous to think that's the case." She wants to reach people who don't know how passionate they might yet be about classical music because they haven't necessarily experienced it yet. Her trademark so-called Expeditions Concert format, in which, together with the musicians, she takes the audience on a journey through a piece of music ahead of a concert, are sell-out events and her own way of communicating her passion for the music. She recalls being 16 and seeing a performance of Igor Stravinsky's Le Sacre du Printemps, or The Rite of Spring. She got hold of the score and brought it into school. "I was floored by it on a complete high. And once I told my friends, they were suddenly all into Sacre." On a recent Sunday afternoon, she sat on the edge of a piano stool on the stage, describing to the captive audience of a packed concerthaus the huge scandal the charmingly dissonant work had provoked at its 1913 world premiere in Paris. Stravinsky, she explained, had finished composing it under the influence of unbearable toothache. It hasn't lost any of its power, she tells them. In the BBC Music magazine for September of 2023, we get to interview up-and-coming conductor Tim Anderson. Where were you born? London, UK. What would be your career highlights so far? Conducting a Shareno world premiere in Klagenfurt during lockdown, the 30th anniversary production of Marc Anthony Tournage's Greek in London in 2018, and working with the phenomenal and fearless musicians of Klangforum Wien. Who are your musical heroes? Wagner, because there is no other composer in whose music I can so completely lose myself. And Ella Fitzgerald. What would be your dream concert? When I grow up, Tristan und Isolde. Meanwhile, I'm about to conduct two operas from my bucket list, Thomas Ade's Powder Her Face for Semperoper Dresden, and Brett Dean's Hamlet in one of the world's most iconic opera houses. In the Christmas 2023 edition of the BBC Music magazine, Femke Colburn reports that a new score orchestrated by Timothy Brock is available for the 100th anniversary of Charlie Chaplin's film, A Woman of Paris. It was the roaring 20s when Charlie Chaplin's first serious drama, A Woman of Paris, had its premiere in Los Angeles. The women wore pearls and flapper dresses. The men crisp suits and Panama hats as they strolled along the bustling pavements of Hollywood in its golden age. Chaplin had a string of comedy triumphs behind him, including Easy Street in 1917, The Immigrant 1917, and The Kid 1921, and the stage was set for his ambitious next project. But things did not go quite to plan. Though it was a hit with the critics, A Woman of Paris left audiences in Los Angeles feeling somewhat bemused on its 1923 debut. They had expected another comedy, a film with Chaplin as the star. And instead, they got a rather dark drama where he appears only in a cameo role. Chaplin had, to some extent, anticipated this response and arranged for flyers to be distributed at the premiere to warn the audience that this work diverged somewhat from his previous films. But he was still stung by the cool reception. Although the film eventually made a decent profit, it was not nearly as popular as his comedies. Chaplin put the setback behind him and went on to make comedy greats such as City Lights 1931, Modern Times 1936, and The Great Dictator of 1940. But he never gave up on A Woman of Paris. In 1976, just a year before his death, he reissued an edited version of the film with a new musical score that turned out to be the last work he would ever complete. Chaplin, who was not a trained musician, but composed the music for his films with the help of professional arrangers, had never been happy with scores for A Woman of Paris before composing his own. Working with Chaplin, Louis F. Gottschalk compiled two different scores in 1923. The second was later revised by composer Fritz Stahlberg, but Chaplin remained unconvinced. Even the 1976 version, composed with Eric James, had shortcomings. Chaplin's health was deteriorating at the time, and he was able to contribute only a handful of new ideas. However, as the film's 100th anniversary approached this year, a plan was hatched for another new score. This time, Timothy Brock, the U.S. composer who has been working with the Chaplin family for many years to restore the director's film scores, was commissioned to create a completely new soundtrack based on previously unheard Chaplin compositions, as well as the 1976 score. This new soundtrack was used in a remastered version of A Woman of Paris that received its world premiere at the Berlinale Film Festival in February. According to Brock, the 1976 score drew heavily on music Chaplin had written for his comedies. But a darker, more serious work required a different approach. "The music sounds a lot like the music from The Kid," he says. "It's quite simple, quite nostalgic, and quite sentimental. But it's such a different film because it's heavy and dark. So the music was not quite as effective as it should have been. The 1976 score is essentially a nostalgic view of the 1920s light comedy music, and it is the wrong kind of approach." Much of the music for Brock's new score comes from previously unheard home and studio recordings that were transferred to CD in 2003. These recordings are of Chaplin trying out his musical ideas on the piano, mostly music that he was composing for Limelight, his only other serious drama. In fact, Chaplin had composed so much music for Limelight that plenty had been left out of the final cut. So Brock decided to use the discarded parts to create a new score for A Woman of Paris. The idea was to use Chaplin's music, and hopefully a lot that people had not heard before, to use all the other music for his only other drama, Limelight, just seemed to make sense, he says. "If somebody had commissioned a new score for me for that film, I would have done it differently. But I didn't want the score to sound anything like me." At the film's climax, where protagonist Jean is loading a gun and about to shoot himself, Brock decided to use music with a rich string sound, reminiscent of Chaplin's soundtrack to City Lights, the gold standard in terms of a Chaplin-esque sound. According to the composer, he tended to write a lot of ethereal string music, especially from the 1940s onwards, and I wanted to achieve the same effect there. There was a passage where Chaplin played on the piano, very slow music that reminded me a great deal of City Lights. In another iconic scene, the character Marie attends a debauched party where the guests are treated to a rather scandalous burlesque performance by one of the female guests. One of the few moments of humor in the film. There, I tried to create an Arabian burlesque type of sound, Brock says. Though he taught himself the violin and cello, Chaplin never had any formal music lessons. He played the violin left-handed, with the strings and bridge reversed. He was unable to read music and described the process of composing as la-laing to the composers he worked with. Perhaps for this reason, Chaplin's music has a humanistic quality, Brock says. It is very melody-driven, but with odd rhythms. He makes a lot of time signature changes, too, but he probably didn't realize it because he just played what he thought sounded right and got somebody to write it down. For the same reason, his music is also often in rather odd chromatic minor keys. Other comedians from the same era, such as Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, or Laurel and Hardy, tended to use somewhat comical music in a bid to enhance the humor in their work. It has a sort of cuckoo approach, Brock says. That is definitely not what Chaplin had. Chaplin's music is not particularly funny. The humor in his work is strictly visual, and the music is what it is. It complements the humor, but doesn't try to be funny in its own right. Before he began working in film, Chaplin worked as a comedian on stage with the Fred Carno Company. The music he wanted to accompany him on stage was elegant, sophisticated music that would counteract the humor, Brock says. I think he did the same thing musically in his own films. City Lights has a very traditional and unfunny score, but with a lot of pathos. The score was recorded with an exact duplication of the forces used for City Lights, with just 29 players. Flute doubling piccolo, oboe doubling English horn, three clarinets, three saxophones, bassoon, two horns, three trumpets, two trombones, tuba, percussion, harp, piano doubling celeste, and strings. The original banjo was substituted with an accordion. At the first rehearsal, Brock turned up with a suitcase full of mutes that modern brass players no longer use. It's my job to get the orchestra to sound like it's playing 100 years ago, he says. It's a unique Hollywood sound. In many ways, it's a period performance. That means an intense, burnished vibrato in the strings, particularly the violins, the brass always playing with vibrato, the saxophones playing with a jaw vibrato where they have to bite down on the mouthpiece, a Moser M55 vibraphone, or older, and drums with real skin, tuned lower than usual. Brock watched A Woman of Paris for the first time almost 25 years ago, not long after he started working with the Chaplin family. I remember turning down the sound after half an hour because I thought, this is not helping, he says. I thought the film was beautiful and very profound, but I always had a problem with the music. He hopes his score will help bring new life to work that, despite its initial lackluster reception, was hailed by German film director Ernst Lubitsch as a great step forward, and went on to have a significant influence on the next generation of filmmakers. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, a service of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me again next week for Classical Music Connection.